Hi, I'm Kevin Harrington, an original shark from the hit television show Shark Tank, and you're listening to the Underdog Podcast. I've been too high up to fall, question marks, what's up with y'all? All we know is overtime, barking like some underdogs. All we know is overtime,
barking like some underdogs. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Underdog Podcast. Today, I have an incredible guest here with me, JR. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thank you so much for being here. It's such a gift to meet awesome people. And I felt it right when you came on camera. I was like, man, JR is awesome. I'm just so excited.
I got to be transparent, though, because I feel like that's the real way you are able to connect with people. And I got to be real and honest. And the couple of days leading up to this, I haven't been my best. You know, just life has just kind of been like a little blah. And I wouldn't say life. I'd say the last couple of days have just felt that, like, felt that way. You know, just not only me just fighting, you know, a little common virus, cold, whatever's going on, what happens when you have kids in the house. But also, it's just, you know, I don't know, like, I find myself, there's little things that get into my head and things that trigger me. And all of a sudden I find myself going down this thought process. And now I start thinking about this and now I start thinking about that. And all of a sudden I'm going backwards in my thought process. And, you know, it's funny when you mentioned how I logged on and I was like, had this energy, you know, I had to mentally get myself in a space knowing that I needed to be able to show up for you and for the people that tune into your show, because this may be the only opportunity I get to connect with you and your audience. And, you know, and I think that's something that I've had to teach myself to do over the years, is that, you know, you got to find ways to kind of curb situations and feelings and emotions and say, okay, let me sort of have a moment where I do a reset for myself. And what's the intention when I log on with Pamela? What's the intention? How do I want to show up? What do I want to accomplish? And that allows me to log on and be like, yo, what's up? And you would never know that the last, you know, 48 to 72 hours have been kind of like a little like, you know, whatever, because my energy is like kind of at 100 right now. But I think that's just something that we all frequently have to be, you know, exercising that muscle and practicing that, you know, because we're always having to show up for somebody, whether it's our kids, whether it's our spouses, our partners, whether it's colleagues, friends, just people we come in contact with day in, day, you know, just day to day. We're always having to find ways to show up. So it's just a little challenge for all of us.
I love that, JR. And I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, it's the era of vulnerability. I think we're seeing it in a way that we've never seen it before. And I can't wait to touch on that and talk about triggers and get into that and how you got into your mental state and like shifting all that up. And I just can't wait to get into your story. And before we get into that, for sure, I would love to know, what did you want to be as a kid when you grew up? Because I want to reel it all the way back, and then we'll bring it right back to the era of vulnerability. What did you want to be when you grew up?
I was so naive. And, this tells you I didn't have the right people growing up in my life. You know, I wanted to be a professional football player. And if you looked at me, you know, I'm 5'9", I'm 200 pounds, I'm not fast, I'm not big, I'm not strong, like, I'm not that dude. And yet I had this naive dream, like probably most kids have, that wanted to play professional sports one day. And, you know, I just grew up and that was all I really had to focus on, to be honest, was sports. I love sports. I love football. You know, my family's from Central America. My mother's from El Salvador. My father's from Mexico. My father wasn't in my life, so I didn't get a chance to get to know him or his side of the family. But, you know, when I went to El Salvador as a kid, I mean, I'm looking at my family members, my cousins and everything. And, you know, they're not in the city. They're not in San Salvador. They're in El Campo, as they say, the country, the field, rural, where there's no lights. I mean, there's no electricity. There's no restroom in the house. You go old school in the woods. You go to a creek, and on one part of the creek, that's where you take a shower. In the other part, that's where you, you know, wash your clothes. And another part, that's where you get water to drink and to cook. And I mean, that's how real it was. You went to bed when the sun went down. You woke up when, you know, the roosters and the sun started to rise. I mean, that's how it was. And so I didn't have much to pull from, to be honest. And where I grew up in the United States, I was born in Shreveport, but grew up in Arkansas until I moved my senior high school to Georgia. But I grew up in these small towns, and there was nobody around me that was like, a veterinarian or a doctor or a therapist or a social worker or a teacher. Like, I didn't have that. I mean, I saw those people, but there was nobody in my life. And my mom would always say the typical things that moms are gonna say is like, I can see you being a doctor and a lawyer. And I'm like, yeah, well, I'm gonna be president too, mom. Like, I mean, my mom had that sort of like really contagious, like love and positivity. But that was my goal. And, I tell people, even though it on paper, it's what I wanted to do with my life when I got older, and even though that didn't come to fruition, it was never supposed to. It was supposed to be my goal that honestly, in many ways, kept me out of trouble. Because I knew if I got in trouble, then I wouldn't be allowed to play football. And so football was kind of the thing that kind of kept me on that straight path a little bit when there were all these different distractions in the community that I grew up in that could have easily pulled me in that direction.
That's incredible. Well, it's insane how one thing can kind of reconnect you in the future like that, right? Like you said, it was like it didn't become that, but it kept you on that path to really lead you to where you are now. And I love, thank you for your family backdrop as well. I'm an immigrant as well. So came from Albania when I was 5 years old here to the United States. And my grandfather's village was much like that too. Like there was an outhouse. There's no real plumbing in the house, So all that. So all the things when we come to the US, I'm like, these are things that, we almost take for granted the fact that we have like actual plumbing in our house, that we don't have to go outside, that we don't, these are blessings that we've got, which is so incredible. I love
Unless you live in Texas, like I live in Austin, Texas, and we moved here in 2018. And then to our surprise, we were like, we're moving to Texas from New York. So we got to get rid of all our, winter coats and our bubbles, as people say on the East Coast and all these others, we don't need that. We're going to Texas. And then all of a sudden we got a rude awakening when it gets cold here in Texas. But then also there was a couple of years where we're losing power, we're losing electricity. I mean, we're losing heat, we're lo like water because of a freeze, a storm that came through, and we didn't have the infrastructure to support it. And I literally was using, I mean, listen, I have a pool, like I have a pool. It's nice. You buy a house and you're like, I want a pool. You live in Texas, it's hot. And I think it makes sense, right? Until you realize in the summertime that when you're like, I'm gonna go jump in the pool because it's gonna be refreshing and cooling, and you realize the sun got to the pool before you did. So it's actually not as refreshing and cooling as you would think. But we're using pool water to flush the toilet because we had no running water. I'm like, yo, what is this? This is 2022, 23. We shouldn't be living like this, and we're having to live like this way. But all jokes aside, I mean, I remember when I would go, because I had the luxury and the fortune of being born in this country. And but I remember going back to El Salvador as a kid. My mother took me back many times, first time when I was six. And you get caught up, especially as a kid, you get caught up in comparing yourself and what you have to your peers. And I'm no different. I did the same thing. Man, I would love to have those fresh pair of kicks. I would love to have this many outfits. I would love to have, live on this part of town or do this or do that, whatever it was. And we just financially couldn't do it. And of course, you go down this path where you're like, oh, my life sucks. And then I remember going to El Salvador and I would get this perspective. And I would, all the things we mentioned earlier, and I'd be like, oh man. And I would come back to the States and I'm like, don't get me wrong, I still want those things. But I'm gonna be a little bit more patient and supportive when my mom says she's gonna put something on layaway and make a payment every week or every other week for 4 months, and I'm gonna get those shoes, or I'm gonna get that those clothes, but it's gonna be, in a few months from now. I was able to just appreciate what I had in this country, and to your point, where listen, I mean, I could go and grab a meal right now. And even when I was a kid and we didn't have a lot of money, my mom made no more than $42,000 a year. If I wanted the burger, I could go get a burger. If I wanted to go to a movie, I can go to a movie. Like I had a roof over my head. I had electricity. I had plumbing, as you mentioned. I had a lot of beautiful things. And I think perspective is important, for all of us, but especially for kids. And that's why, listen, I got two kids and my kids have a great life, and that's the goal of a parent, is to always give your kids more than what you had. But at the same time, I don't want to get caught up in this trap that I want to, because those very things that I experienced and I became aware of as a kid helped shape me to become the person that I am today. And so why would I all of a sudden refrain from my kids being exposed to that same very thing? I don't want them to be exposed to the hardship, but they need to be exposed to perspective. They need to have perspective. They need to understand what they have and how there's a lot of kids, you know, that don't have what they have. And it's not to gloat and be like, I got it made. No, it's to be like, wow, I can empathize. I can have compassion for another individual. It makes me appreciate when my daughter who plays select softball is like, you know, there's like a new bat out and it costs 400, 500 bucks. And I'm like, all right, you know, I can swing it for you. I can make it happen for you. But that wasn't something that my mom could do for me. And so, hey, yeah, I'm going to do that for you. But what are you going to do? Right? How are you going to earn it? How are you going to show respect? How are you going to, you know, work hard and show your appreciation for this? I don't need you to pay me back. I need you to work hard. I need you, you know, and so it's these lessons that, you know, I see this a lot in parents is where the very things that they were exposed to in their youth that helped them become these incredible adults, they try to shield their kids from experiencing. And they're like, I don't want you to have that difficulty, so I'm going to do it all for you. Well, now you're going to the other end of the spectrum, and now you're just kind of creating kids that just everything gets handed to them, done for them, and what lessons are they really learning? So it's this balance you always got to, and I think the only way you can manage that is you always have to be, you have to really pause and have reflection and be really aware and have the right people around you that you trust that when they come to you and say, yo, JR, reality check real quick, you don't get defensive about it. And you're kind of like, you know, it's coming from a good place.
Amen. And as a mom of twin girls, that's one of my balances that I'm definitely going to be, you know, because they're going to be first generation here in the U.S. So there's a lot of checks and balances. And it's like, how do you not spoil them, but also let them learn their lessons at the same time and still, you know, remind them to be, you know, to be in gratitude and all the things. They're 7 months old now, but they'll be.
Start them now. It don't matter. Get them out there now, Pamela. Don't wait. Now's the time. But it's funny because like when my daughter, you know, I do a lot of philanthropy work and that's where it all started for me. But when I started doing a lot of the philanthropy work, again, when I had these moments where I was getting all caught up in my own life and what was challenging and difficult for me, I would find myself getting out of that by putting myself around other people that were experiencing their own trauma, their own challenges. And it just gave me perspective. It gave me a reality check. It allowed me to find community and connect with people. Now, a lot of those people, are they in my life today? No, a lot of them are not. They probably weren't intended to be in my life long term. They were intended to be in my life during that period of my life when I was going through something very difficult and I was just trying to figure out who I was now. And I know we'll get into all that, but you know, I still do a lot of work with different philanthropy nonprofit organizations. And what I do is my daughter's 11, my son's 2, so he didn't quite get it yet, but my daughter's 6, 7, 8 years old, and I'm taking her to events so she can see people that, you know, have different wounds, right? Visible wounds, who talk about emotional wounds, who talk about all these different things that, and the challenges and how it's made them better. And I'm exposing my daughter to that because I want her, you know, to be able to, when she gets into the world and she's on her own and she encounters an individual that starts to really share something that's pretty heavy and deep, that they're just waiting for one person to listen to them, or she encounters somebody that looks, you know, different, that this awkwardness stage is sort of kind of not even present because she could just see the person. And so I'm instilling that in her now. So when she gets into the real world, there's not like this shock effect where it's like, hold on, give me a few months or a few years to really kind of get over seeing your scars or get over seeing or get over hearing about how life has been difficult for you. Now, let me just connect with you on a human level, because that's all that matters.
Absolutely. And I love that you mentioned that, JR. I mean, and I can't wait to hear your story in detail. My goodness, like your philanthropy work. And then like, we got to connect. We have so many things to interconnect here. I love it. It's fabulous. And I would love to hear kind of like your life experience. So coming out of like high school and kind of what your trajectory and your journey was and kind of like the ups and the downs that you experienced throughout that time.
Yeah, so it was difficult, you know, for me. So I was born in Shreveport, Louisiana. Like I said, my father wasn't in my life. He left when I was 9 months old. early and you know, for the first 9 years of my life, I lived in Louisiana, and I experienced, you know, I just witnessed a lot of hardship there. My mother was in a couple of different abusive relationships, and I witnessed that. Kind of came to, you know, just like I actually still like in my head have I can still smell, and my mind's, it's almost like you spend enough time in a hospital and then you just know that smell. But and I know that one, but I also know the smell of beer. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I remember like on the weekends, Fridays and Saturdays, it was like, I mean, they're and what they drank was Budweiser, and there would be Budweiser cans, and the next day you'd wake up and walk outside, and you know everybody was there drinking, and it just smelled like beer, and you just and so that's kind of like the environment I grew up in, where it just he decided to put his hands on her one night, and you know this happened multiple times, but I would call the cops, and I'd be hiding in a closet, and they'd come and take him away, and or somebody else would get taken away because there was some sort of domestic disturbance, you know, our neighbor. I mean, there was always something like that, and it just wasn't like this environment that I think a lot of therapists would say is best for a child that's developing, especially. I mean, you could say this for both, but like a young boy, right? Like it's like I'm seeing men put their hands on women, and it was kind of like no big deal. And there was a slap on the wrist in the sense of where they got taken away, but then they were back at the house, you know, 48 hours later, once they were able to post bail, you know, they were back at the crib, and it was wild. And so at 9, we moved to Arkansas, and where I moved in Arkansas was predominantly white and black, and I was one of the first Hispanic kids to be in that community, and it was challenging. I mean, that presented its own challenges where I felt completely as an outsider because it was only my mother and I was just this lone wolf and made me an easy target. I mean, you know, we talk about bullying, we talk about hazing, we talk about, you know, all those terms that are being thrown out in the world now. But I mean, I was susceptible to that. I found myself getting my ass whooped for no reason just because I was by myself. I found myself getting jumped for no reason just because I was simply by myself. And I felt so isolated and out of place. And I remember there were more Hispanic kids starting to show up in the community. And I thought, all right, cool, here come my people. Now I'm not by myself. I'm rolling deep now. And all of a sudden, now I wasn't cool enough to hang out with them. Like there were reasons why we weren't cool enough. And I don't know if this is true for where you and your family are from, but you know, like there was all these reasons why, like, oh, you're from a certain part of Latino America, right? You might be from Mexico, but you're from another part of Mexico. You speak differently. You speak Spanish differently. Or, oh, but you were born in the United States. You're not real. You're not real Mexican or Salvadorian. And there was all these, and maybe some of that was envy because I was born here and a lot of them had not been born here. I don't know what it was, but regardless, all it did was just further pushed me into this space of feeling like I don't belong here. And I used to always dream as a kid, man. I used to dream about this whole world that was out there and that existed. And I wanted to be part of that world so badly. And I didn't know what the world, you know, essentially was about, but I just like, this small town can't be it. This can't be it. And I remember vividly having those thoughts. And I could tell you how, and I'll be again transparent with everybody, but you know, when I was 16, I literally had thoughts of wanting to get into a car accident just because I wanted to see how many people would actually show up at the hospital. I wanted to see how many people actually cared about me, how many people gave a damn about JR. And that tells you everything you need to know right there. At the same time, like I, you know, was a kid that from an academic standpoint in school, I wasn't thriving. I was not doing well. I'm not the kid that, you know, you have a teenage kid and you say, hey, you follow what JR? No, you don't follow JR because JR was just mad and angry at life. And so all I was doing was getting myself into trouble, fighting nonstop and getting suspended from school for 3, 5, 7 days at a time. I mean, this was during the era when, you know, I could literally just be suspended. My mom wouldn't even know. And I would literally just roam around this small town. I would leave school. I would leave the house. Sorry. I would leave the house in the morning at the traditional time that I was supposed to leave to go to school. And I would just walk around the town. Like I would be ducking and dodging, like doing all this crazy stuff. And then come home at like 3:34 and be like, school was good. My mom worked the graveyard shift. So my mom was working all night. I had to get myself up at school. For school at 9 years old. I had to get myself to school at 9 years old. I had to get myself home at 9 years old. I had a tremendous amount of responsibility. And, but I just, when I would go back to school after these suspensions, of course, I would fall behind from a curriculum standpoint. And so my defense mechanism was to be a fool, was to act a fool, was to be a clown in the back of the class and be like, that's stupid anyways. And that was my defense mechanism. And that's how I protected myself. And all that did was just affect my grades. And but do you think anybody ever stopped and pulled me aside and said, hey, kid, what's really going on? Why are you acting out this way? What's going on? No, nobody. All they did was essentially, as the saying says, kick the can down the road, let it become someone else's problem. Maybe somebody else will pick it up. No one did. And at the end of my junior year, I finally moved to Georgia. And I could tell you within the first, you know, couple of months of being in this community, I started playing football. I found a community of people that were like me, that were first generation, that were called Chicanos, you know, those kids that the Latinos, the Hispanic kids that are born in the U.S., you know, Chicanos, and we kind of spoke Spanglish or broken Spanish or, you know, like, I mean, and I found my group of people that I rolled with and I rocked with, and I felt like I had a community for the first time in my life. Also, within the first few weeks of being in this new school, a counselor pulled me aside and said, hey, man, I'm looking at your transcript, your grades. What's going on? Literally. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, like, that's been the basis of my life, is where it takes one individual to take something away from you, but it equally takes one individual just to sit down and say, hey, what is going on? Instead of just kicking the can down the road, just show up. And we spend so much time, we know we want to show up for people, we know we need to show up for people. But we spend so much time thinking, how am I going to show up for this person? That in the mix of thinking so damn much, you don't even show up at all. And all that person needs you to do is just be present. And together, you will figure it out. And my childhood was tough. It was tough. And so even though in comparison to what I experienced while I was in the military is not the same, right, from a trauma standpoint, from an adversity standpoint, I believe all of that adversity was preparing me and conditioning me to actually deal with the big thing that was going to come later in life. And so when people come up to me and say, man, what I've been through, I'm going through this, and what I'm going through or what I've been through is nothing compared to you, you know, so, and I'm like, hey, stop doing that. Stop comparing trauma, right? Like, let's not compare adversity to one another. What it is true and it is real, it is raw for you. It affects you. What happened to me was real and authentic and affected me. So let's not get into this game, because all it's doing, it's preparing you, it's conditioning you. But and so I've just had this life where life has taught me that. And that's the way I look at a lot of adversity that I've been facing over the last 21 years of my life, is I'm like, yeah, there's something I'm taking away from this right now. I don't quite know what it is, but I just know I got to keep showing up and get through it. And on the other side of that mountain, I'm going to get the lesson that I needed to learn the whole time.
I love that, JR. Oh my goodness, that was powerful. Thank you so much for sharing that. And it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because I had a similar experience in middle school. So like, I was bullied like my early elementary school. So I was, and ironically, I was the whitest kid in the whole school. So it was all.
Where'd you grow up?
In Chelsea, when I lived in Chelsea, Massachusetts, essentially it was all primarily Hispanic, a lot of us El Salvadorians for sure.
We should have switched spots.
I know.
And then you would have been golden and I would have been golden.
Exactly. And so it was funny, like, you know, and I had that whole bullying experience. And then I went to seventh grade and, like, you know, same thing, like kicking the can down the road, like you were saying, like, you know, no one really asked me. I was really a quiet kid. Like, I didn't want to speak to anybody. I was like so traumatized, because every time I did, it was like I would be shunned for something, even though, like, just for being myself, you know, because English was my third language. And so, like, I, you know, European, like, nobody really could connect with me or where I was from. And so when I got to seventh grade, that's when everything shifted, and then my whole personality changed. So your environment really does make a huge difference growing up. 100%. I can't stress that enough. I mean, Dr. Bruce Lipton, he studied epigenetics, and I don't know if you're familiar with that, JR, but if you're not, something I definitely think you would be interested in kind of looking up, because he's done studies for over 40 years that talk about how literally our DNA shifts when we're in different environments.
I'm not familiar with that, but I'll have to look it up afterwards. But I can completely relate to that, because, you know, I became this kid that I think, you know, in many ways, I mean, I was you know, maybe some way, some you could probably say depressed in some regards, you know, with the thought of wanting to get into a car accident. I mean, you can maybe throw out that word suicide. I mean, I don't know. I mean, but I mean, it's not who I always was, right? I mean, I have my son, I look at my son, and my son is, and my daughter is too, but my son's is big, big personality, big smile. I mean, just love and just great energy. Walks into a room, doesn't know a stranger. I mean, I remember when we potty trained him, he walk up somewhere and I'm like, say hi and tell him your name. And he's like, I'm Leo. I pee pee and poo poo in the potty. And they're like, oh, that's great. And he's like, yeah, I pee pee and I poo poo in the potty. And they're like, okay, great. And I'm like, oh, I told my wife, I was like, this is going to be the dude we got to worry about. He's going to be telling everybody everything that happens in this house. So we better be careful. Our wife, our daughter, man, she'll go to the grave with the secrets of the house. Our son, he's going to be telling everybody, like my dad's always slapping my mom's ass. Like he's going to be that kid telling everybody everything. Right. And so, but I see him and I can't help but think, that's who I was as a kid. I was a kid that was incredibly compassionate. Like somebody is upset in the house and he goes up to him and he says, why are you crying? Why are you crying? And he wants to give you a hug. And I remember when I was 3 years old, one of my sisters passed away from an illness that she was born with. And I remember this. And I remember my mom on the other side of the bed. And it was dark, like kind of dark in the house, but there was a lamp on and she was on the phone and she was like collapsed onto the ground holding the phone and she's crying. And I remember going over to her and saying, Mama, why are you crying? Mama, why are you crying? I love you, Mama. I love you. And giving my mom a hug. I vividly remember that. And so the reason I say all of this is because when you talk about how your DNA shifts, I mean, there was a point where I was no longer that same kid. Right. Like I was starting to become somebody else. The environment was shaping me to become something completely different, which was changing the very thing you talked about, which is the DNA. And so that's why when I encounter people that I'm like, man, that person's not a pleasant person right now. Like, what's that person's problem? I'm always kind of going to that place of like, okay, what has happened that has kind of shifted them? What has happened that has created them and molded them to be where they are right now, right? Again, you could equally say you shouldn't allow those, you know, it's not a, you don't have a right and you can't treat people this way or whatever. But when people are hurting, I mean, they're not aware they're hurting. And so hurt people hurt people, right? I mean, that's the saying. And so, you know, and so for me, I can 100% connect with that. And that's why I try so hard as a father. I try as a husband, as a friend, as just somebody that just shows up every day in public. I try to be a contributor to that's going to help people's DNA shift into a positive state. Whether it's already there, great. Then I'm just going to be another force that's going to help validate and just push you in that same direction. If you're kind of on the cusp, then I'm probably going to be a little bit of like a, you know, sort of a shaker and be like, hey, come back on this side. You're good. You got this. If you're not, then, you know, I'm one of the people that you're, because it's not just one person. Maybe there's multiple people you're going to have to continuously encounter that's going to sort of shift you back into that space. And so it really is important that we all show up in the best way that we possibly can. And if you feel like you can't show up, then, you know, I always say, hey, then maybe, like, I always try to. It's weird. It's weird because my daughter the other day showed me this book she was reading and it's called Flipped. And I said, oh, what's it about? And she's telling me this story about these two kids that grew up together. And like the girl likes the boy doesn't have interest, but then later he has interest or whatever. And when you looked at the cover, though, there's a bird on it and the title of the book. But then when you flip it, like the bird's upside down, but the title of the book is right side up. But then when you flip it, title's upside down and the bird, like, and I was like, oh, that's a cool cover. She was like, yeah, because it's kind of talking about how there's like different perspectives. And so I'm like, ah, I like that. And I'm like, yeah, because I always say in my house, both things can be true, guys. And so when I don't feel my best and I feel like I can't show up, I'm transparent. And I'm like, hey, I got nothing today. You know, Brene Brown talks about how her and her husband do this exercise where she gets home and she's like, She's like, hey, I'm at a 30 today. That's all I got is 30. And he's like, okay, cool. He's like, well, I'm at a 70. So I can kind of carry us through the evening until you kind of get to a 50, 60, 70, maybe at 100. So, but always kind of connecting with yourself. We talk about inventory and what you have in stock. And it's you have to do that as well as an individual. And you always have to be mindful of what you have in stock. What can you actually give to people? What can you give away to people? And when I feel like I don't have a lot to give away, I'm transparent and I'm like, hey, I'm gonna need to like have a couple of hours or maybe even a day or two just to kind of like process and be with myself and go through my own practices that is gonna get me out of this space. But I also have this on the flip side, which is why I say both things can be true. I'm also a huge proponent of throw yourself out into the world. Now, don't throw yourself out into the world where you're going to maybe be in an environment that's not going to, help pull you out of that. But throw yourself out into the world because the world will give you the energy if you're willing to just go out there and listen. And I think that's the key. Don't go out there and try to show up and force it. Go out there and just listen. Don't speak. Just listen. Just pay attention. Just show up. And the world will give you what you need in that moment. I am a huge believer in that.
Absolutely, absolutely, Jared. You're dropping gems everywhere, my friend. I'm just listening to you, just like, whoa, this is amazing. And I would love to hear a little bit deeper into your story, like when you were mentioning when you went into the military and then kind of like coming out of that, and then how it put you on your current track. I'd love to kind of see that, hear more about that, and then that way we can talk, kind of circle back on the vulnerability side of things, because I think that's so important. You mentioned triggers at the beginning of the call, and I'm like, man, this is gonna be so helpful for everyone, because even the ones who claim that they're fully healed, there's no such thing as
Yeah,
fully
there's
healed, though we're always learning, we're human, right?
nah,
So I would love
nah.
to kind of circle back on all of that.
Yeah, so when I realized finally after high school that maybe college and pro football was not actually going to be something part of my future, it took that long to realize that. I was like, what am I going to do with my life? And just one day I saw a commercial on TV, and it's so cliche and so predictable, but I saw a commercial and I'd heard about the military a little bit. Obviously, nobody in my family had served in the United States military. I had an uncle that I think served in the Salvadorian military long, long, long time ago, but never talked about it. But I'd heard about the military. Recruits are always at different events and throughout the school year. And I think one of my football coaches had served in the military at one point. And so it was just kind of like, okay, it's not completely out of left field. But I remember going and speaking to a recruit, and I went to all the branches, and the Army was the one that kind of spoke to me. And it was mainly, honestly, because the Marine Corps, that's where I wanted to go to. And they were like, but you can only do 4 years, the minimum. And I was like, nah, I don't want to do 4 years. I'm trying to negotiate with the Marine Corps here. I was like, I'll give you three. And they're like, nah, four. And I'm like, three. And they're like, nah, four. And I'm like, all right, then I'm going to go next door. And because you got the mall, they got all the branches lined up right there, and Air Force wasn't even there. And the Navy, I just ruled them out because I was like, I can't be on water for that long a time. So I went to the Army, and the Army was like, they're like, huh, how long were you thinking? I was like, I can give you three. And they were like, sold. And they were like, we'll take you. And so I joined the Army, and honestly, the military was a one-stop shop for me at that time in my life. It was an opportunity for me to travel. Again, I'd grew up in these small towns, and I knew that there was a whole world out there, and I wanted to experience it. The military was going to give me that opportunity. It was also going to give me the opportunity to travel. It was going to give me the opportunity to get money for college. It was going to give me an opportunity to give back to a country that had given so much to me and my family. I graduated the year after 9/11, and so there we were very, very involved in conflict already as a country. And I, like a lot of people felt like, I wanted to do something. And I did feel compelled to serve and to help because of, again, I understood the luxuries and the privileges that I had by being born and raised in this country compared to, my family members that didn't have that same luxury, despite its imperfections, right? Like, there's no such thing as perfection. But yet I was still incredibly indebted and grateful. And so off I go to basic training for 3 months. I get, assigned to my unit, which was the 101st out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I'm 19 years old, and I'm, Pamela, I'm living on my own, even though I'm living in the barracks, but I'm living on my own. I'm around these guys that have, you know, older, that have this extensive training. I mean, these dudes, a lot of these dudes are badasses, man. Like, these dudes have some badass training in a lot of different areas. And I instantly felt like, oh, I'm a badass too, just because I'm around these dudes. And, you know, I was just naive. I was naive. I mean, I was away from home for the first time. I was going out, having a good time. I was, you know, figuring out my role within this organization of the Army. And, you know, one day my sergeant, you know, came and had a conversation with me, and he was talking about how I needed to be prepared because we were going to deploy sometime soon. And he was referencing that I needed to mentally be prepared, not just physically. And because he saw me cutting up just every day, just like it was like a I was on a comedy tour with a bunch of my comedian buddies, and we were just working on material every day throughout the day. And he was like, this dude doesn't realize that we are in a time of conflict, and there's rumors about us possibly going over to another conflict. And he had this conversation with me, and I still walked away from that like, nah, it ain't gonna happen to me. I just, like, 6 months ago, I just joined the military. Like, it's too soon. And sure enough, like, I was on a plane 2 months later, heading over to war at the age of 19 years old. And I mean, oh my God, like, the thought process is, I mean, I couldn't even wrap my head around what? Like, I'm going to war. They showed a movie on the plane, a Mel Gibson movie, We Were Soldiers. And if you've never seen that movie, oh my God, like, it's so gruesome and real and raw about war. And I think there was their way of kind of mentally preparing us. But all it did was it shook me to my core, because I didn't have the luxury to train. I didn't have the luxury to understand what war was about. And so the biggest thing I had to do was just rely on the people around me. I mean, that's all I could do, was just watch them, you know, kind of like when I started practicing yoga again. You know, you go into that workout class and you're like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing, but you're watching everybody else. And then you're trying to, you know, you're trying to, like, do it too. And like, Warrior Two. And you're like,
yep.
Now reverse your dog. Like, you're like looking around the room. I'm trying to, like, position myself in the room so I can have eyeballs on everybody, you know, and by the time someone looks at me to see what the move is supposed to be, I already know what I'm doing because I've already scanned everybody else. But that's essentially what it was. Is like, I just, like, watched everybody on the plane and while we were in country, and just try to wrap my head around this thing. And, you know, I think there's a couple of stories that are important to tell. So you hear constantly about service members, veterans talk about the camaraderie, the brotherhood, the sisterhood, you know, that whole connection, and how they miss that when they get out. And I agree, that is 100% real, that exists, but it didn't quite exist for me. I can tell you early on that I would get I would ask a lot of questions because I didn't understand war, and I was just trying to understand war tactics and strategies, and what was I supposed to do if I encounter this or encounter that. And, you know, I remember one of my sergeants just constantly just, like, being annoyed that I had so many questions, and I was inconveniencing him. And all that did was just put a sour taste in my mouth. And I was like, man, forget it. I'm just not going to ask any more questions. Even though he never said, Martinez, like, stop asking so many questions. His body language said it, right? Like, his body language said everything I needed to know. And so I just kind of put a sour taste in my mouth where I just started just going through the motions. And I was just like, man, I don't even want to do this anymore. And I couldn't wait for this deployment to be done. I couldn't wait for my 3 years to be done, because I wanted to get out. I wanted to move on with my life. This wasn't for me. One day, one of our commanding officers gives a briefing, and this man talks about, he introduces this concept of service to me. And he talks about the importance every single one of us play in accomplishing the mission on this team, and, you know, owning the role that we have. And he's going deep into this explanation. And I'm like, oh, man. And I remember going on a mission, you know, the next day, and I remember thinking to myself, like, man, I was part of this mission. Like, I'm a very small part of the mission because I'm a private in the Army, but nonetheless, I'm part of the team. All that did was, it was like, okay. Again, another example of, it took one person to take it away, but one person to give it back to me, and times 20. Because then I was like, man, I don't want to just, you know, do 3 years in the Army. I want to do 20 years in the Army. And when I get done with this deployment, I want to go back to the States and go to this school and that school. I want to be this highly decorated soldier, you know, in 20 years. I mean, that was my thought process. And I think it's important to share that, along with, because that's true in any organization. You're always going to have somebody you work with in any organization that's going to be like, oh my God, annoyed, or, you know, doesn't want to give you an opportunity to speak. They may say that, but they don't. They sort of making you feel like you're not, you don't bring value. They don't necessarily care about what you have to offer. They don't appreciate what you actually offer. And then you have other leaders that are like, nah, like, I want you to understand the role you play. And so the thing I always tell people is like, if that means that you have to move organizations to find that consistent people, the consistent people that are going to support you and encourage you, that's what you got to do. And, but also too, I remember one of my leaders, he gave me a briefing one day and he talked about how we're a brotherhood and how we're always going to look after one another. And I'm getting a little ahead of myself here, but I could tell you that the day after I was injured, I never heard from that man. And I still haven't heard from that man. And it's been 21 years since that accident. And I still haven't heard from the guy that literally gave me this whole briefing about how we're always going to be connected and bonded and look after one another. And that dude was the first one to bail and never reach out to me. And so, as you can imagine, all that does is put a lot of resentment in my heart. And I started, because all that did was my father left me. There's been these other things. The other people have left me, that abandoned me. This guy gave me his word that we're going to be connected and bonded and look after one another. Now he bailed. Everyone else in my unit hasn't reached out to me. You know, no one's come to visit me in the hospital. Meanwhile, I walk around and everyone else has visitors. Like, what's wrong with me? Like, it's just, I mean, it's a perfect recipe to send me down the hole that I actually ended up going down, which was a very dark one.
My goodness, my goodness. And it's fascinating to hear you talk about the story too, and how you were completely like unprepared. And then when you went out and experiencing all these things for the first time, right? Like, you just don't know. Like, my COO on my real estate side, so he actually served in Iraq as well. So first and foremost, forgot to say thank you for your service, because that's tremendous, tremendous. And without our vets, I mean, this country, you know, wouldn't be what it is. So yeah, first and foremost for that. But my COO served also in Iraq too. And he's like, Pam, it's just, I don't know how to explain it to you. You know, it's just a totally different world. And thank God, you know, he came out with no issues, no nothing, and was able to come back home. But I think he served something like 4 years.
Listen, I'm not going to be the one to sit here and say that everybody is scarred, whether it's physically or internally. I don't want to put that label on everybody, but I know that a lot of troops come back with something, and just some scars may not be as deep as others, as prevalent as others. But I know that every vet is, especially when you serve during, you know, these conflicts, I mean, there's something you've had to navigate. And so just make sure you give him a big shout out on my behalf as well. Thank him for his service and what he's contributed to this country. But it was one of those things, you know, I cannot not share this, but because people ask me like, were you afraid? And I was like, you know, I was never afraid of dying, which is weird. Like, I never had a thought in my mind like I could die. And part of that is just because I was naive and a kid. But I never was like afraid of like being shot. You know, I was infantry, so you still had to train on hand-to-hand combat. You still had a bayonet that you had to carry with you and train with. And I was like, I was never afraid of being stabbed. I was like, didn't really faze me. Didn't put a lot of thought into it. The one thing that scared the hell out of me was a landmine. And we had to learn how to defuse these Claymore mines. And every time we had to do the practice, I was like, I want no part of this, because even though it was, you know, it was a dummy one, but still, like, I was like, I want no part of this, because it just terrified me. The idea that something could be hidden and when pressure is applied and then released, it detonates, like, that just, it just freaked me out. And think about like, and that's what people have to understand for a lot of vets, not all, but for a lot of vets, that's why it's so difficult coming home, because you've lived, if you've done one deployment of a year or multiple deployments of a year, I mean, your nervous system, talk about your DNA, I mean, and the environment, I mean, you're constantly like unaware of, like, you don't know, I could literally like be behind this and it could be something, I could be like behind this camera and there's something, like, you just always, and so I was so afraid of that. And the day that I was injured, I was driving a Humvee, and the front left tire of the Humvee that I was driving ran over a roadside bomb, a landmine. Oh. The very thing that I was terrified of, and the thing that almost cost me my life. I'm in this Humvee for 5 minutes, completely conscious. I'm screaming and yelling. I can see my hands changing. I could I could feel my eyes getting heavy and they would close and I would just breathe and I would just almost like kind of accept that I'm going to die in this way at this age. And I remember like telling myself like, no, you can't keep your eyes closed because that means you're giving up. And this is where I always say the 19 years prior to that very moment had conditioned me to actually believe that all I needed to do was just continue to show up and fight. And 5 minutes later, I was pulled out of the Humvee. I was put into a medical induced coma. I was taken from Iraq to Germany. And then from Germany, I was brought back to the United States. And I was in a coma for 3 weeks. And I remember when I came out of this coma, one day I was talking to my mom and I told her how I had this like dream, this visual, this, you know, you're on drugs. So you're like, all sort of trippy shit is happening. And, but I, for some reason, like I had this dream, this image, this picture that I was at a NASCAR driver's house. And I don't even watch NASCAR. But I was at his house and it was like this big function. There was all these people there schmoozing and my mom and I were there and I was sitting on the couch and all of a sudden I can see coming through on the floor is a snake coming straight at me. And the snake lunges right at me and goes right into my mouth. And I grab the body of the snake and I'm trying to pull the snake out. And the snake, like I'm wrestling with it, and it takes me to the ground. Everyone else rushes over, and instead of trying to pull the snake out, they're pushing the snake further down into my throat. And my mom is standing there, and my mom is just like crying. And I'm like screaming, freaking out that this snake. Well, this is where it all kind of comes together. So, as much as I talked about my fear of a landmine, my other fear in life that I have that is still very real till this day is snakes. Oh, snakes freak me the hell out. Like, and I live in Texas and I can tell you when I go in my backyard or I go anywhere, I'm like, just like this. Like I got one of those snake little tools to pick it up, knowing damn well I won't do it, but I got the tool to call my neighbor for him to come over and do it. Like, I'm like, hey, all I need you to do is come over. I got all the stuff that you need to pick that snake. You need a bucket? I got the bucket. You need the little long tool thing? I got that too. You need some gloves? I got that too, but I ain't gonna do it. But I got people in my community that'll do it. But I'm so terrified of snakes. And later I met somebody that actually was part of the medical team that initially took care of me in country. And she told me that I was fighting everybody off and I was telling everybody that I was fine, just let me go back. And so what that was, the snake in my mouth and them pushing the snake, it wasn't a snake. It was them intubating me because that's really what had to happen. They had to hold me down and intubate me and push it down because I was fighting them because my body was going through the state of shock. But it surfaced in the way of fear.
Wow.
And so it's fascinating. Like fear is a really fascinating, you know, topic for me because I've kind of learned like, hey, I was so afraid of this landmine and that was the thing that almost took my life. I'm terrified of snakes. And in my mind, a snake was the thing that was taking my life, was attacking me. And so when fear kind of presents, when I feel something that I know like, ooh, I feel like a little terrified of this, I find different ways to channel that. And I find ways to utilize that. And I try to find a way to sort of tell my mind and my body like, hey, this probably isn't as much of a threat as you think it is. And let's focus on something else. And not to be like delusional, like this toxic positivity approach, like we're no, everything's okay. Everything's no. It just means that I'm going to look at the scenario, evaluate why I feel triggered, and then say, okay, what is it about that situation? Because it isn't on the surface of what I see or what's happening. There's something deeply rooted in that situation that is triggering me. And that's what I like to focus on. But I like to tell that story because, again, it's just another example of how the things you fear are, if you give it too much power and too much weight, it controls you. And it ultimately is the thing that ends up, essentially, in many cases, probably consumes your life.
Absolutely. I love that, JR, and thank you for bringing that like full circle, because that was the trigger question from the very beginning that we started with, right? So it's so true, because you're absolutely right. Like when it comes to snakes, I mean, I'm absolutely terrified of them too, but it represents itself in your mind. Like the mind is a very powerful thing. right? And you program it however way you want to. And you know what's crazy is when you awaken and you become aware of how to control your mind, because sometimes when, you know, you live by, oh, if it's meant to be, it'll be. We fall into this, right? Oh, if it's meant to be, it'll be. It's like what people fail to realize is that we are co-creators with our higher power and our highest selves. And so we make choices every day. We get into those mental states, like you mentioned earlier. You got into this state of mind in order to receive and with intention, right? Like you went in to, especially with this conversation, right? And you said, I really want to have an in-depth conversation with Pam and really share my story, right? So it's like walking in, it shifts everything. And the minute that you realize that you can actually control with your mind every scenario and how you show up in the way that you show up, I think that's the most powerful thing you could ever know, right? Like, am I living life via my subconscious and like getting caught in these routines that you're not even aware of? The minute that you pull yourself out and say, oh my goodness, like I'm actually in control, I just have to shift my mind, you know, my state of mind in order for me to be in the right place to receive. And recognizing those triggers, I think that's a real big piece of it, right? Like, it's like sometimes we just get angry at stuff, get reactive, but like, do you ever stop and think, what is causing that trigger to really surface? How can we heal that? And how can we move forward and change our state so therefore we can create our external reality? Because very much so, our inner reality is what shapes our outer reality. It's both the same thing. So it's just a question of what are you creating up here that then resonates and gets created out here? Because it's a story every day, every day.
100%. And, you know, I recently saw this Tony Robbins clip on social media, and he was being interviewed by some guy, and he asked the guy, he says, look around the room and see if you see anything that's brown. And the guy looks around, and Tony's like, you see anything brown? And the guy's like, yeah. And Tony's like, did you see anything that was red? And the guy was like, no. And he was like, all right, now look around and see if you see anything red. And Tony's like, did you see anything red? And the guy's like, yeah. He said, why didn't you see the thing that was red before? And he was like, he's like, because you weren't looking for it. He's like, so the point of that is, like, whatever you're looking for, you will find. I mean, you can find anything to support what your thoughts. I mean, so that's why you have to be even more conscious and aware and careful. Like, if you're having these negative thoughts and you go and, I mean, you can feel that. If you decide to have these positive thoughts, you can feel that. You can find what you're looking for. And so for me, it took me a long time to realize that, though, right? It wasn't suddenly. Listen, I spent nearly 3 years in the hospital recovering. I got out when I was 22 years old, and I got into the world, and I had this new purpose and this new vision that I wanted to be this speaker, and I wanted to share, and I felt like I had a lot that I could bring to the table. And all I kept experiencing was rejection. And people telling me that I'm just a veteran. I would have been, I'm better off just talking to other veterans. Why don't I just stay in that bubble? And so all that did was trigger me, because what that was triggering me, and the way it was triggering me was like, nobody's listening. You know, no one's really, you know, right, kicking the can down the road. No one's really paying attention. No one's leaning in to find out what's really going on. Like, they're allowing their biases to, you know, to dictate how they respond to me. And it sent me into a dark place. And listen, for a couple of years after I got out of the military, I mean, I was drinking, I was angry, I was not a pleasant person to be around. I was hurtful in my words. If I felt somewhat threatened, then I attacked first. And when I attack, it's no joke. I mean, listen, this is a gift that I have to be able to communicate, but it also, when used the wrong way, it is the worst gift that I can have. It is the worst tool that I can have in my arsenal. It is my superpower, but it also is the thing that can literally just shatter somebody's world. And I'm aware of that in myself. And I know that I have that ability. And so I'm always trying to be very conscious of that, because I know that sometimes you go too far, it's hard to come back. And I went too far in a lot of scenarios, and I'm not proud of that. I mean, I was just 22, 23, 24 year old kid, just hurt and trying to navigate life and trying to show up as best as I possibly could. And it literally, I mean, if I was in relationships with girls, and the minute that I felt like things were getting almost like too comfortable, I started finding a way to create a scenario where I would push them away. And nah, you're getting too close, getting too real. Nah, get away, because you know what? Everybody hurts me in my life. I mean, listen, we don't have the time, and we can always circle back at another time in life. But, you know, my mother, as great as she was, she also she challenged me, and she kind of instilled in me some patterns and some behaviors and some thoughts, and so she brought some trauma to my life as well. And you know, so there was all these people that were constantly just like, nah, letting me down. So anytime something felt real to getting close, get away, get away, get away, get away, get away, push people away, push people away. And it took my best friend one day encouraging me to be vulnerable and telling me that I needed to cry. And I was like, man, I don't need to cry. And I was a typical dude, like, nah, I don't need to cry. What are you talking about? And he was like, nah, man, you're hurting, and you need to let that stuff out. Now, mind you, I have been crying, but by myself in a controlled space, right? Which I think it's healthy. I think it's healthy for you. Whatever you feel, you gotta be present with those emotions, because that's how you become aware of why am I feeling this way? You know, what triggered this? Like, that's the work you gotta do, and you can only find that out yourself. And that takes stillness, and that takes being honest with yourself. And so I'd spent a lot of time writing and crying and just, you know, I mean, probably angry writing, but you know, nonetheless, I was getting stuff out. And but I never cried in front of anybody else until that night when he was like, man, you need to cry. And let me tell you about the power of that moment. You know, this friend, he would always tell me, we worked together, and you know, for the nonprofit that we were both supporting, and he would always tell me he loved me. And I thought that was so weird. I'm like, all right, bro, I'll talk to you later. Like, I just didn't know how to respond to that. I was like, all right, cool. And then that night when he was encouraging me to cry, and then all of a sudden I started crying, and I just started, like, all of a sudden, just like all this stuff, right? All this stuff that I wasn't even aware of. And at the end of that conversation, it felt so incredible to have a human being show up, that I was the first one that looked at him and said, I love you, man. And he's my homie. He's my homie till this day. Love him. 17 years older than me, but he's my best friend. He's like my big brother. He's like my dad. He's like everything to my family. And I attribute all everything I have to him, because again, here's this DNA of this person, JR, that was born with this really good energy, positive, compassionate, like, I mean, all this stuff, and life and my environment was constantly just changing my DNA and hardening me and hardening me, hardening me. And all people were doing was like, oh man, every time they encounter me, they're like, we don't want to lean into that. That is threatening, and that is alarming, and that makes us feel uncomfortable. So we'll just kick the can down the road. And he was the first one that said, let's pick this can up and see what's inside of it, and let's see what we can do with it. And that's when my life changed. And so that's another reason why, when it's time for me to show up, I try to show up, because I never know if I'm going to be that individual for somebody else the same way that he was that person for me. And so it's such a, so I had to learn about vulnerability, and I didn't learn through reading a book. I didn't learn through listening to a podcast. I didn't learn through, you know, I learned by feeling it, and being around people that created safe spaces that allowed me to be vulnerable, that didn't use it against me, that didn't judge me based on what I shared. And then I started to realize that that's what people want. People want people that are vulnerable, that are transparent, that are authentic and real. And I started to just operate from that truth. And the more that I started operating from that place, my life kind of took off. I got an opportunity to become an actor. I got an opportunity to go on Dancing with the Stars. I got an opportunity to write a book. I got an opportunity to travel around the world. I still do a lot of motivational speaking. I started my own podcast and just connected with people to learn about that, you know, their lives, but a sort of one pivotal moment that I like to call the rebirth moment, when something ends and something else is born, but that thing that's born now sends you on this trajectory to do this incredible work that, you know, we know you for. And that's just, I, you know, and it's all rooted in just me authentically just finding ways to be transparent and vulnerable. But it took a lot of work. I mean, I could tell you that obviously it, you know, I've gone to therapy a few times. I've gone to therapy at different stages in my life, and I think it was really good for me, and it's healthy for me, because, you know, I was good enough when he and I had that conversation at 24. It got me to a good enough place that it lasted me a few years. And then things got heavy. And then around 28, 29, 30, I went back to therapy. Then I had to go back to therapy again a couple of years after that, you know. And so every stage of life is sort of kind of bringing something new to the table or resurfacing a different component of your trauma. I'm not afraid to say that. I'm not ashamed of it at all. I own it. And I'm like, it is what it is, but it makes me a better person. And I'm able to show up as a father in a better way. I'm able to show up as a husband in a better way, as a friend in a better way. I'm able to show up as JR, who I've always been this person. I'm able to show up as that person.
I love that, JR. Oh my gosh. And as you were sharing that about your friend who said, I love you, man. And it reminds me and takes me back to this whole thing, which I find so important. Having those cheerleaders in your life, you just need one. One person who asked you way back when in middle school, hey, what's going on here when you switch schools and your transcripts? And now this gentleman kind of coming in. And then now, how incredible is it that you get to be that cheerleader for other people and share your story so that your message can get out there? And that's exactly what we did here today. You never know who's listening right now. Yeah. That could be empowered and impacted by your story, which is incredible. So being that cheerleader is quite possibly the most important thing in the world. And the second thing you mentioned that I love and respect so much is that authenticity. Yeah. The authenticity in yourself, right? That's what really attracts the world to you, right? Like, you got all those incredible opportunities because you are authentically yourself and you stepped into your power and you were vulnerable. You were healing all of those wounds that you had. Had you not done the healing, you wouldn't have opened yourself up to new, right? You would have been the same old bitter JR.
That's true. Right? But let me drop another nugget for you real quick. So after all this success and stuff, I got away from that. I got away from my purpose. My purpose is to serve. I mean, that's what I believe my life is here for. I'm here for. I'm here to serve. And I got away from that. And I started taking opportunity just because the money was good. I started taking opportunities and being busy because it was cool to say that you're so busy. And because people, like, you know, are sort of gloating about, you know, maybe how good you are and the field that you're in. And I found myself now being motivated by that. I was motivated by all that, the wrong things. Like, it's fine. Like, all of us want to be successful. All of us want to have financial freedom. All of us want to be able to, I get all that. Like, it's nice to have a little pat on the back. I mean, hell, when I do speaking engagements, they have like a little reel that they play for me. And it's a montage of all these photos and videos with music on it. And it makes me look like a rock star, like a badass. And I think about it, what if every single person in this world had their own reel, their own hype video that they played for themselves every morning when they got up, or when they're having kind of a slump in their day or in their week and their month and their year, they played for themselves. What would that do? What would that do for that individual? Because I know what it does for me before I take that stage. Man, it gets me to a point where it allows me to appreciate the journey, but it also gets me ready and lets me understand I am here for a reason. So let's have some fun, ladies and gentlemen. And so I'm able to show up. But the moment that I started to be inspired by the wrong things, guess what happened? Got taken away from me.
Mm-hmm.
It got taken away from me. And I spent like a year or so where I was like talking to my agents. What's wrong? What's wrong? What do I need to do? What do I need to do? And, you know, of course, they're like, we don't know what's going on, you know, whatever. And what I really realized what I needed to do was I needed to just stop trying to find the next thing. And I needed to stop and go back to practicing stillness. And I needed to go back to practicing really being present with my own breath and my own self and being completely honest and transparent with myself. And I started going, I had a black lab at the time, and that was my firstborn. And he and I would go to the park and we'd sit there for hours. And I'd write and I'd think and I'd talk, and, you know, and through that work, I identified, one, I needed to go back to therapy, and two, that I needed to get back to, that's the reason I believe things were being taken away from me, is because I was operating from the wrong place. And so the minute that I got back to my core and operating from that place, guess what? The universe said, okay, you're ready now. We'll give it to you. Here you go. And more opportunities started to present themselves. So I'm very careful at this stage in my life where I don't want to find myself just saying yes, 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 nonstop, and being overwhelmed and then now operating from a different place. I don't need a lot. I have a great life. I'm like my family, we're taken care of. We're good. I don't need too much. I just need to do the things that at this point in my life bring me peace, bring me love, bring me joy. That's it. And just challenge me to continue to evolve and grow as a human being. If it doesn't fulfill one of those things, it's not for me right now. And I don't have to say yes. I don't care how good the money is. I don't care who's going to be at the event. I don't care who's going to gloat about, JR, you got to do, I don't care. Like, it has to serve me in a certain way because my time is too valuable. And as I've learned, because I've had a near-death experience, as I've learned, life is fragile and precious. And at the same time, not all of us are going to be blessed with a second chance or a third chance or a fourth chance. Like, you may only have one chance. And if you get a second one, that may be your only. If you get a third, that may be your only. If you get a fourth, man, golly, I want to know who you praying to, because I'm going to start praying to that same person too. But like, the point is, we just got to understand life is fragile. And this whole mindset of like, go, go, go. Nah, that's why, like, when you think about like farming, there's like a season, right? Like, you just plant, nothing is growing. There's no harvest. Like, you're just planting seeds. You don't even know what's going to stick. You don't even know what's going to happen, but you're just throwing seeds down nonstop. I mean, we got to be in that season too, as human beings.
Amen. Amen, JR. I love all of that. And speaking of seasons, like, what's next in your season? What's the next season looking like for you in the next few months? Like, what are you up to? Like, what's going on in your world?
I really want just thank you again for the opportunity to come on and rap. I really enjoyed it. You never know, especially like you and I didn't know each other before we logged on, and you just never know how the conversation is going to go, how energy is going to, you know, connect. And I felt really positive energy from you. So I appreciate your energy. I appreciate the platform you've created and your willingness to allow me to connect with you and your audience. But this is what I love to do as well. And so, you know, I had a podcast called Rebirth and had it going for a few years and then decided to stop for a second and just kind of like figure it all out and piece it all together. But that's the thing that I'm looking at trying to kick back up is the podcast. I'm still doing a lot of speaking, but I'm in this really cool place in life right now, Pam, where, you know, I have an 11-year-old daughter, I coach her softball team, and, you know, I have a 2-year-old son, and it's just a stage of life where it's like, you know what? I don't need to be gone all the time. I need to be very selective. And these are the things that bring me so much joy and happiness. And I love doing it. And I don't know what's really next for me. I know I entertainment stuff. Yeah, I want to get back into it, but you know, the right opportunity will present itself if it's meant to be. Until then, I'm just going to be working on connecting with people, learning from people when the podcast kicks off again. But in the meantime, I just hope people hit me up on social media and just have conversation with me, because at the end of the day, that's what I love to have is just conversation. So my handle is I am JR Martinez. So if anyone feels inclined, come hit me up. Come say what's up. Come tell me you heard me on Pam's podcast. And it'll be good to kind of share some story and rap about this experience.
You're amazing, JR. Thank you so much for sharing all of that and just your whole life experience and all the important nuggets and lessons that you shared throughout. My goodness, it was tremendous. And your energy is beautiful. And I love that you come from such a place of authenticity. And that's just absolutely, absolutely incredible. You know, you're definitely a cheerleader in this world and you will shape so many lives out there. So thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate you, Pam. Thank you so much for the space.
Thank you.
So that's it for today's episode of Underdog. Catch us next week, always dropping on Thursdays. And remember, if you're interested in real estate or want to learn how to create more money and magic in your life, check out meetwithpamela.com and let's chat. Sending you so, so much love. Underdog. All we know is overtime, working like some underdogs.